From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. When we look at the general Roman calendar, the collection of dates that the church celebrates throughout the year, solemnities and feast days, and otherwise, we have only a few that relate to miraculous events. And of course, you'd probably guess that I get excited when these dates come up, and we're talking about May 13th, Our Lady of Fatima, or Lourdes, or Guadalupe. But there's another big one. That's July 16th. That's Our Lady of Mount Carmel, celebrating the apparitions of Our Lady of Mount Carmel to St. Simon Stock, and of course, the initiation of that brown scapular. I was able to travel to Aylesford in England, where that apparition was said to occur, and we're going to be talking about that today on today's program. We'll be speaking with Father Jeffrey Kirby, author of Journey to Mount Carmel, a 9-day preparation for investiture in the brown scapular of Our Lady. We'll also be talking about one of the future African-American saints, that is Augustus Tolton. We'll be talking to Joyce Deriga, author of Augustus Tolton, The Churches of the True Liberator, and we'll be finding out what's next, perhaps, on his path to sainthood. Check out my EWTN television series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tonight, I'll be going to the most visited Marian shrine in the world, which is at Mexico City, Our Lady of Guadalupe. And I'll be there to investigate how the mysterious image emblazoned on St. Juan Diego's tilma has inspired millions of believers. And check out my other show, They Might Be Saints, next Thursday on July 20th. We'll be looking at the episode Sister Marie de Mondat Grance. That was our very first episode that we did. It's the one that started it all. It's a fascinating story of how Sister Marie de Mondat Grance, we follow her extraordinary efforts to locate the house of Mary, the mother of Jesus, as she travels to Ephesus, Turkey, to bring this treasure to the Catholic Church. Absolutely amazing story. It's a little bit of an Indiana Jones tale, so check that one out. And believe it or not, there's a new television series that's just launching. It's called Hidden Gems, Catholic Shrines in America. I'm the executive producer of that program, and we just filmed our first episode this week at the National Shrine of the Miraculous Medal in Perryville, Missouri. It'll be out in fall and beyond of the various episodes, but just a heads up that there's a new program that's on its way called Hidden Gems. Check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural, out from Tan Books and available from EWTNRC.com. People ask the question, is the church anti-science, and is science ever involved when they investigate miracles? And the answer is no, the church is not anti-science, but yes, it actually employs scientific investigation when looking at cases of stigmata or weeping statues or Eucharistic miracles or healing miracles. So that book details all the various ways these investigations occur. Later in the show, we'll be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project. We'll be looking at the Etruscaya icon of the Mother of God from Croydon in Australia in the year 1739. The might-be saint of the day is Blessed Felissimo de Mosciano, who lived from 1070 to 1092 in Italy. And the question of the week, it's a funny one, or a hard one at least. We hear this one a lot. Is it possible that there's an imposter, Sister Lucia of Fatima? I'll do my best to answer that later in the show. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we talk about the miracles happening on the world and those things that relate to miracles. For people who want to find out more, you can connect to my Instagram feed with 25,000 followers. We just went over that mark this past week. And or you can connect to me on Facebook or Twitter as well. And there isn't big miracle news, just future miracle news, you might say. We're talking about Venerable Fulton Sheen. Now, he is the only person in the entire Catholic world who has an approved miracle, the healing of a boy who was, his name is James Fulton Engstrom, who recovered from not breathing after 61 minutes. And that's an incredible story. We've interviewed his mother on this program in the past. And hopefully his beatification will be following soon. And because his beatification got paused, the news for this week is that there was a Sheen rally this past week which aimed to reignite his beatification mass. In the Fulton Sheen Movement, it held a Fulton Sheen Rally. It's an all-day event. It took place on Sunday, July 9th, at the Annunciation Byzantine Catholic Church in Homer Glen, Illinois. And this event focused on rediscovering Venerable Fulton Sheen's messages for our times and the signing of a petition to have his beatification mass rescheduled soon. And there were various Sheen-related activities. And so this was all to promote the cause of beatification and pray for powerful graces for the church through the intercession of Sheen, the article said. And the event will included prayer, celebration, inspiration, food, and various activities to celebrate and advance the cause of the archbishop. Of course, people may remember a few years ago when his beatification was scheduled and going to happen there in Peoria, Illinois. News came out of the Vatican, or the instruction came from the Vatican, to pause that and not do the beatification mass. And we've just been in a holding pattern, finding out what's going to happen next. So stay tuned for more information on Fulton Sheen. You'll hear it here first as soon as we find a new beatification date for a future American saint. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer that writes in with the correct answer. And last week we were talking about Our Lady of Akita, the weeping and bleeding statue from Japan. Just had the 50th anniversary this past week. And so the question was related to weeping statues. From what state in the United States was the most recent case of a bishop-approved weeping statue? And the answer is New Mexico. So in Hobbs, New Mexico, in the year 2018, a large bronze statue of Our Lady of Guadalupe at the parish of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Hobbs, New Mexico, was weeping tears of oil on four different occasions. And this was captured on film, posted on YouTube. You can actually Google it and look for it. It's absolutely amazing. The bishop there, the bishop of Las Cruces, New Mexico, Oscar Cantu, he released a statement saying that there was no natural explanation for the phenomenon that was happening. And I've visited the foundry there in Mexico that built that statue or created that statue. And that's the only one they've ever made, they say, that they call her La Milagrosa, the miracle worker. She's the only one that weeps tears. That is a very recent one that was featured even in the Washington Post. The trivia question for today is, there are four canonically crowned statues of the Virgin Mary in the United States, and one of those is Our Lady of Mount Carmel in New York. We're talking today about Our Lady of Mount Carmel. Can you name any of the other three canonically crowned statues in the United States? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the Image of the Faces of Mary, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com or just go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and send me a message that way. And answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking to Joyce Dariga, author of Father Augustus Tolton, The Church is the True Liberator. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who tune into this show know that I love talking about future saints, future American saints specifically, and I do a program on EWTN called They Might Be Saints. We've done about 20 episodes or so of various Americans on the path to sainthood. We're talking about servants of God, venerables, blesseds, before they have all their miracles and are declared saints by Rome. One of my favorite episodes that I got to do and I got to film in Chicago, I call it my own city here in Chicago, was about the Father Augustus Tolton, the first African-American priest. And we had a number of excellent interview subjects on that program who really made it a very special program, and I was so excited to do it. And one of those guests was Joyce Dariga, the author of Augustus Tolton, The Church is the True Liberator. And we welcome her back to the program today, Joyce Dariga.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Good, good. It's good to have you back on. And I always like talking about Father Augustus Tolton. I think he's a future saint that many Americans are excited about, and they need to know more, and the word needs to get out on him. And I think it was a fun project to work with you on the episode of They Might Be Saints, and with Bishop Perry as well. So that was that's a big deal, I think, someday when he will be declared blessed and saint. Why do you think, in your opinion, that Father Augustus Tolton has sort of inspired such interest over these recent years?
I think because of the holy life he led in the face of great adversity, right? He was born into slavery, and then his mother fled with him and his siblings to Illinois. And then, you know, there was still a lot of racism at the time. The Civil War hadn't been over yet. He had to work in poor conditions. And then, you know, just becoming, trying to get to be a priest, even to be educated in the Catholic faith and such. It's just he had a ton of adversity, you know, and then he never lost his faith. He didn't. There were some at the time that followed him who would leave the church or become very despondent, or, you know, some turned to alcoholism and things like that. But he never lost that passion and that belief that the church, as I have subtitled the book, is the true liberator for free Black folks in the United States and people of all color around the world. So I think he's just a truly holy inspiration for many people.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the subtitle of your book, The Church is the True Liberator. Where did that come from, and what does that mean for you?
It came from talks he gave. He gave a lot of talks with that title, because when he went to study in Rome, he really got steeped in the church's history, and the church has always taught that, I mean, hasn't always practiced it, but the church has always taught that there's color doesn't matter or class doesn't matter, and he would have seen that down the ages. The church has spoken out against slavery and whatnot, and so he learned that. So he was convinced that the Catholic Church was the true church for all Black people in the United States, and so he spoke on it all the time. And I really think it's a wonderful thing to meditate on, because, you know, we're so flawed, and the church is built of living stones, and, you know, the church owns slaves, and people in the church own slaves and such. But it's a good thing to meditate on, because to realize that the church doesn't have, you know, distinctions against race or class or maybe disabilities, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the very interesting aspects of the life of Father Augustus Tolton is how he found his vocation. I think that he went through some incredible challenges and obstacles to get there. And of course, being the first African American priest, nobody would doubt that that's true. I mean, I think that he went through an incredible journey. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, where did his vocation come from, and how did he get going with that, with so many obstacles in his way?
Well, the priests in Quincy, and many of them, well, they were all white, really supported him and helped foster his vocation. He was always a faith-filled child. Apparently, the slave owners were Catholic, and then they educated their slaves in the faith. So his mom was by all intents and purposes, a very holy woman, too. And so he was always visiting, stopping by the church when he was going to work and different things. And the priest sort of took him under their wings and really noticed that he would have a vocation to the priesthood, and started forming him in that, with that goal in mind. And then the Franciscans in particular took him in. They had a college down in Quincy, and they took him into the college to start teaching him the things that, like German and Latin and things you have to know in the priesthood. And also they really took over writing to all the seminaries in the United States at the time to try and get him entered. Unfortunately, none of them would take him, but they eventually got him accepted to the college in Rome, so he was able to go there. But he knew, you know, he would know that he would be the first openly Black priest in the United States. There were the Healy's were biracial, but didn't identify with their African descent. But so he would be the first one. And at the time, he thought he was going to Africa, but then he got sent back here to be a missionary. And I always think about that, too, how lonely and scary that might be. Like, yeah, you're excited you're going to go back and see your family and back to your home country, but you're also going to be the first black priest in the United States. And what's that going to be like? You know?
And what, and we're talking today with Joyce Driga, author of Augustus Tolton, The Church is the True Liberator. What was that like? I mean, that had to be quite a shift for him, being mentally prepared to go to Africa, learning some cultural and language aspects as he was going to head out. And then they switched him to go back to his hometown. What was that like for him? How did people receive him there?
Initially, it was great fanfare and great love. Like, they had people went and met him at the train. They decorated the church, and and by all accounts in the newspapers and stuff, they talked about how beautiful the Mass was and really just raved about, apparently he was a good preacher, raved about his preaching skills, and they started flocking to his church. And that's kind of where the problem started, because it really was the jealousy of his brother priests, who saw both white people and black people going to his church, and they would worship together. And you know, Bishop Joseph Berry, who's our the postulator of the cause, talks about he was a man ahead of his time, because whites and blacks both worshiped together in his churches, and that was a problem for the local priests. So they started making life difficult for him, which is what eventually led him to leave Quincy and come to Chicago. So
what did he absolutely amazing path that he took. And then he ends up in Chicago. And of course, people who have Chicago connections like the two of us, we see him as a very important person in the history of Chicago. Tell us about his time in Chicago. What did he do there?
Well, he was given the ministry to minister to all the black people in Chicago. So he was, and he was also asked to build a church, which took a while. Like, he had to raise money. He would often go speaking to raise money to help build the church. But the congregation grew really fast. You know, it started off with, you know, less than 100 people. And then after a couple of years, he had several hundred people come into the church. But he was also, there's an area in Chicago called Bronzeville, which was because of the color of people's skin who were living there. And that's where he was living, and that's where the church was. And so we know that he also ministered to non-Catholics. And it was, people talked about being able to see like an ordained minister who looked like them. And so, you know, just like in Quincy, he spent hours and hours in the confessional, and his mom moved here with him, and his sister came, and they all lived together until his sister ended up getting married. But it's just everything that I read in for this book, like there was even a in the Chicago Tribune at the time, they did profiles on the ministers to the black community, and his had the most amount of text. It was the most glowing. They talked about him being very charismatic and just very poised, and even the Archbishop at the time put him in charge of different things. He was celebrating a big anniversary, and Father Tolton was put in charge of the children who would come and sing and different things. So he had, I mean, he was, I think that's kind of how he got run down, and his health got really poor, because he was always kind of burning the candle at both ends kind of thing. And so, today's the anniversary of his funeral in Chicago, as you probably know.
Amazing. Yeah, what an incredible life he lived. And I think so many people are excited about his canonization cause. And, of course, we interviewed Bishop Joseph Perry in the program on They Might Be Saints about that, and he's spearheading that cause. And what an exciting pursuit to see if he can be named the first African-American saint. And right now he stands as venerable, meaning his life of heroic virtue has been examined and validated by Rome. And so they formally decreed that some years ago. And now they're in the stage of looking for a miracle. With one miracle, he'll be declared blessed. A subsequent miracle, he'll be declared a saint. Where do things stand with his canonization cause right now?
Well, the Vatican was here, or people from the Vatican were here about a year ago, investigating one of the miracles. So there is some hope and forward movement that it might not be long before he can be beatified. So we're hopeful. Bishop Perry's convinced that it'll happen in our lifetime. I really think it could, you know.
I do, and I do think that the Vatican has put a high priority on the sainthood cause. So, at the first opportunity, I'm sure with a validated miracle, they'll be moving it forward. And as we wrap up the interview today, for people in our modern age that's so split by racism and other challenges, what can we learn from Father Augustus Tolton? Why is he a good intercessor for us, and why is he a good model for us?
I think it kind of goes back to the subtitle of the book, The Church's True Liberator. That's something that we can be inspired by. We can model his witness. I think he would be very sad with the way the world is today, that it hasn't changed too much since he was his time. And, you know, we even have, I think we as communities can, religious communities can think too, as to look to him, I'm sorry, as an inspiration, because oftentimes, at least here in Chicago, we have our ethnic churches or our Black churches or our Polish churches, and, you know, they're just supposed to be churches, right, where we're all coming together and welcoming each other. So I think he's a real inspiration in that way, too, for the church in the United States today.
Absolutely. And the name of the book is Augustus Tolton, The Church is the True Liberator. Where can people find this book?
You can go on Amazon.com or Liturgical Press is the publisher. So you could go to Liturgical Press. I think it's litpress.org.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Joyce Driga, author of Augustus Tolton, The Church is the True Liberator, for joining us on today's program.
Thanks for having me.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be trying to answer the question of the week. What about the theory that the original Sister Lucia of Fatima was replaced with an imposter? Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And there's a question that keeps popping up over the years, and I don't really answer this question because it's a complicated one, and it seems like people have their own opinions about what the answer should be or would be or could be. And of course, it's a controversial topic. So I'm not going to have an answer necessarily for you, but I think that there's a good way of looking at this. So the question is, dear Miracle Hunter, my question is the theory that after 1967, the original Sister Lucia of Fatima was replaced by an imposter Sister Lucia, who confirmed the validity of Pope St. John Paul II's 1984 consecration of Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary in union with the bishops of the world. Thanks very much for your attention to this matter, Mary. So thanks, Mary. She's asking for clarification about Sister Lucia of Fatima. There's been a controversy over the years in which there's been the claim that Sister Lucia of Fatima, the visionary, the oldest of the three children, was actually replaced after her death or after some other situation by an imposter. And one of the things that has been fueling this is that there are various photos that are posted all over the internet where they post comparisons of the size of the jaw or the teeth or the eyes of Sister Lucia in different photographs, and they say it's absolutely impossible that this could be the same person. And so there's been a lot of debate on both sides, a lot of people pointing at science and pseudoscience to come to that decision. And of course, if they're trying to say that if it isn't the real Sister Lucia, then her affirmation of the consecration of Russia didn't really happen. And so it's a complicated kind of thing. But we do know that the Vatican, after many years of research into the life of Sister Lucia, just a week or so ago, 2 weeks ago, declared Sister Lucia venerable. So anybody who knows anything about the investigative process for declaring somebody venerable, they must turn over every aspect of the person's life, their writings, their speaking, any correspondence that they have, their meetings with people, their life of virtue, their total history must be uncovered and unearthed. And so it has taken them many, many years to go through Sister Lucia's many documents, as many as 10,000 written letters or other pages that she's put together. And so they've gone through the whole process. They've looked at her entire life, and they declared her venerable just very recently. And so in this process, of course, when they examine every aspect of her life, they would also examine the potential imposter scenario. So I think we have it on pretty good hands to know that they went into her life in great detail and ruled that out. But one of the most convincing aspects for me related to this, and you can look at the science and the pseudoscience that relates to the changes of a person's face over the years, is the family members who visited Sister Lucia in her convent in Coimbra in Portugal. And this happened consistently over many years. And of course, you could recognize your family members no problem if they were to be swapped out with somebody else. I'm sure that would have come up. So for me, that's a very clear indication that we're dealing with the same Sister Lucia all the way through. But I know there are conspiracy theorists out there, but there's no reason to get excited about that, in my opinion. Thanks for your question, Mary, about this tricky topic. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com. And maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up exactly to the day's date. We all know Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th, or Our Lady of Mount Carmel, July 16th, as we'll be talking about today. And for each and every day of the calendar year, we have a different Marian miracle, feast day, basilica being consecrated, or other way to celebrate the Mother of God all around the world. So for today's day, we have the Atriskaya icon of the Mother of God from Croydon in Australia in the year 1739. And the story goes that a priest ran into an illuminated icon on the tall grass when he was mowing hay near his church in Atakaira in Russia on July 15th, 1739. For 3 years, he kept the icon in his house. When the painting lit up again, the Virgin Mary appeared to him in a dream, telling him to wash the icon. When finished, he went to empty the water in the river, but the Mother of God told him to use it to bless the sick instead. And when his own daughter drank some, she soon recovered from her illness. An investigation in 1751 looked into the miracle of the icon, recognizing it as wonder-working. After an exile, it was later moved to the Russian Orthodox Archdiocese of Australia. And the feast day is July 15th. And that is the Atriskaya icon of the Mother of God from Croydon in Australia. For more information on this fasting devotion, or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can go to 365dayswithmary.com, pick up the book, or download the free app, 365 Days with Mary, on the iOS App Store, or you can join any of the 10,000 followers who are on the Facebook page of 365 Days with Mary. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We always we talk about this because I have a television series on EWTN that looks at the lives of people on the path to sainthood. We're talking about servants of God, venerables, blesseds, before they have all their miracles and are declared saints by Rome. And so we always want to tell you who's coming down the pike, who's being processed, and who will be saints next. And so on June 22nd, in Sainthood News, here it is, on June 22nd, 2023, the Holy Father received in an audience His Eminence Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, the prefect of the Dicastery of the Causes of Saints. And during this audience, the Pope authorized the same dicastery to promulgate a decree regarding the heroic virtue of the servant of God Antonio Pagani, born Marco. He's a professed priest of the Order of the Friars Minor, founder of the Society of the Dismissed Sisters, Daughters of Mary Immaculate, and he was born in Venice, Italy in 1526 and died on January 4th, 1589 in Vicenza in Italy. And according to the website for the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, he was a professed priest of the Orders of Friars Minor, founder of the Society of the Dismissed Daughters of Mary Immaculate. He endured trials and humiliations with heroic fortitude and patience. He was a victim of slander, put on trial, and declared innocent. He forgave his accuser and the brothers who had doubted him. And that is the new venerable servant of God, Antonio Pagani, from Italy. With one miracle, he'll be declared blessed. A second miracle, he'll be a saint. And check out theymightbesaints.com for more information on future saints and the show They Might Be Saints. And the might-be saint of the day, we always look at people progressing on the path to sainthood, servants of God, venerables, and blesseds. For today, July 15th, we've got Blessed Felicissima of Moschiano. He was born in 1070 in Moschiano in Sant'Angelo, a diocese of Nocera Umbra in Italy. As a young man, he became a Benedictine monk at the monastery of San Etrisio near Norcia in Italy, and he was soon forced to leave to help support his poor farming family. He worked as a cowherd, praying while he was in the fields every day and giving all that he could to people, even poorer than himself. And he was a hermit near Pulcano in Italy, where he spent time in prayer for the conversion of indifferent Christians. And he was known as a miracle worker. Sounds like my kind of guy. He died on July 15th, 1092, near Pulcano in Italy of natural causes, and was beatified in 1618 by Bishop Virgilio Florcenzi. And so that is the might-be saint of the day by Blessed Felicissimo of Moschiano from Italy. For more information on They Might Be Saints or the show They Might Be Saints, which airs on Thursdays, this week we have Sister Marie de Mondegrance, the fascinating story of Sister Marie de Mondegrance going through her extraordinary efforts to locate the House of Mary. So you can check that out at theymightbesaints.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Father Jeffrey Kirby, author of Journey to Mount Carmel. Stay with us for that.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We talk about the big Marian feast days in our church, and today is July 15th, so tomorrow, July 16th, we have the feast day of Our Lady of Mount Carmel. It's a big one. Most people don't really put this together, where Our Lady of Mount Carmel stems from or where the devotion originated. We talk about, of course, Mount Carmel, but then we talk about in Aylesford, England, in the year 1251, we have St. Simon Stock receiving a vision of the Virgin Mary and receiving that brown scapular. And of course, that is one of the most popular sacramentals in the history of Catholicism. So absolutely amazing. I know so many people with that brown scapular devotion. And so today we're joined by someone who has put together this great book, this Journey to Mount Carmel, a 9-day preparation for investiture in the brown scapular of Our Lady. And that is Father Jeffrey Kirby. Welcome to the program today, Father.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be with you.
It's great to have you on, and I'm so glad you put this book together. And I think so many people are kind of interested in the brown scapular. I have many friends who wear the brown scapular, and of course, there are various colors of scapulars, green, white, black. There's even a purple one, I think, and a red one and a blue one. But the brown one is by far the most popular, and people are kind of interested in this tradition, this history of how this came to be. Just last year, I was in Aylesford in England, and I visited the site myself, and I was able to talk to some of the people there who had this devotion and could talk about the history. But where do we get the devotion related to Our Lady of Mount Carmel?
Yeah, so it goes to the very heart of the mystical tradition of the Church. So if we go to the Old Testament, we see Mount Carmel as a place of great protection and refreshment. First of all, literally, because Mount Carmel is actually a whole mountain range. Sometimes you might think it's just one mountain, but it's actually a mountain range that's in the whole north of the Holy Land. So it would protect God's people from invasion, from enemies. And it's right on the Mediterranean. So it was a place of fresh springs and natural water. And so as it became literally a place of protection and refreshment, that was spiritualized. And the prophets in particular loved going to Mount Carmel in order to feel the protection of God, to be rejuvenated by him, to encounter him, to wait for him, to listen. And so there, Mount Carmel, a literal mountain range that still exists. You can still go and visit there. You can still see the cave of the prophet Elijah there on Mount Carmel. From that Mount Carmel, In the early church, there are men and women who are called to draw, who are called to draw closer to Mount Carmel. And as they grew closer and closer there to Mount Carmel, they became hermits, so kind of a hermit community that began to develop. They had powerful visions of Our Lady, powerful experiences and healings of Our Lady there at Mount Carmel, which is why very quickly they became known as the Carmelites of Our Lady. And then as the needs of the church grew, those hermits became mendicants, so the begging friars like the Franciscans and so on. And that's when they began to spread throughout the church. That's where we find Simon Stock in England, because the hermits of Mount Carmel became the friars of Mount Carmel. And of course, that spirituality has been shared with us throughout the church.
Amazing. Yeah, I think it's a surprise for some people to find out that the scapular devotion in St. Simon Stock stems from England there in Aylesford. It's a pretty amazing thing to see how that devotion spread all over Europe.
Yes, very much. In fact, you can imagine that from Mount Carmel in the Holy Land to England with St. Simon Stock, Our Lady covered the known world with her mantle. And so the scapular that was worn by the religious, Our Lady abbreviated and gave to St. Simon Stock, with the powerful promise that anyone who died wearing the scapular would not suffer the fires of hell. And it was a powerful devotion at a needed time. You know, the spirituality of Mount Carmel is about waiting, it's about listening, it's about allowing God to work in our lives. That was needed in the church in the 13th and 14th centuries. It's needed in the church today, which is why, in particular, I very much am promoting Carmelite spirituality, especially through the brown scapular. Just be reminded of what Our Lady wants to do, how she wants to help us to draw closer to the Lord Jesus.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Father Jeffrey Kirby, author of Journey to Mount Carmel, a 9-day preparation for investiture in the brown scapular of Our Lady. Before we get into how someone goes through this investiture process, let's talk a little bit about the pious legend, the tradition that we have of Simon Stock receiving this vision of Mary, and in that vision, he's given the brown scapular. What do we know, and what is said about this event?
Yes. So the church was in great difficulty. There was massive compromise and corruption in the life of the church. The Holy Spirit was rejuvenating and renewing the church, especially through new religious orders, the mendicants, so the Franciscans, the Dominicans, the Carmelites. And that was very much needed in the life of the church. And so Simon Stock receives this vision, Our Lady gives the scapular. And the scapular, for those who don't know, for the laity, for those who are not Carmelite religious, it's just two small pieces of wool cloth that are worn over the shoulders through strings. And so there's a part of the scapular in the front, part of the scapular along our back. And Our Lady gave the scapular to St. Simon Stock, and really was meant as a call back to holiness, a call back to the Lord Jesus. And it was a visible reminder to the Christian, to the baptized Christian, of their consecration to Jesus Christ and our call to follow his most excellent way of love. So, again, the scapular was instrumental in the reform of the church at a pivotal time in the past. And my work and my argument is that it can be just as instrumental in the reform of the church today.
Wonderful. That's a great thing. And I think that people find inspiration in Our Lady of Mount Carmel. They find comfort and grace from her under this title. When we talk about this 9-day preparation for investiture, I think with perhaps some other sacramentals, we would say that this should be should be blessed by a priest, and then you're good to go with that sacramental. But in the case of Our Lady of Mount Carmel's brown scapular, we talk about an investiture. Talk about what that is and how people go through that process.
Yes, it's powerful. So ideally, it would be the investiture would be by a Carmelite priest. When a Carmelite is not available, then that's delegated to any priest of the church that can invest a person in the brown scapular. And the process of investiture is really fanning in the flame the graces of baptism. So if someone's not baptized, the scapular, it can do nothing, right? The work of the scapular relies upon the graces of baptism. And really, in many respects, the scapular actually looks like a yoke, you know, when it's worn. Mm-hmm. So in many respects, we can imagine carrying the yoke of the Lord Jesus, realizing that we're consecrated to him. And so I think in many respects, the scapular can be a great help. And the investiture is a reminder of that, that, you know, to the average Christian, we live in a secular world that, you know, kind of says, hey, you know, you belong to Jesus Christ. Like, you know, let's begin to follow his way. So the investiture is very important. It can only be done once, although there can be devotional reinvestitures at any time. But the investiture is only once. It's basically when a priest places the scapular upon the shoulders of the person and offers a blessing. And it shows that the person is dedicated to the Lord Jesus through the intercession of Our Lady. And again, that investiture depends on the graces of baptism.
Yeah, amazing. We're talking today with Father Jeffrey Kirby, author of Journey to Mount Carmel, a 9-day preparation for investiture in the brown scapular of Our Lady. And I'm going to ask you a tricky question here, Father, and it's one that I've read various things about it. And of course, I'm talking about the Sabbatine privilege. This is the idea that if you die with the brown scapular and you have that devotion to Mary, then on the first Saturday after your death, you'd be taken to heaven. What do we know about the Sabbatine privilege, and is this something that the Church still stands behind?
Yes. Oh, yes. The Sabbatine privilege is still authenticated by the Church. It's a promise of Our Lady that those who die wearing the scapular in a state of grace, that you know, the first Saturday after their death, Our Lady will come and take them from purgatory and basically remove whatever temporal punishment might still exist. And that's a powerful promise. It's connected to the promise that Our Lady said those who die wearing the scapular will not suffer the fires of hell. And as we offer and speak about these promises, I want to clarify that in the material world, a promise is quid pro quo. I give you this, you give me that. It's a business transaction, right? But in the spiritual life, a promise is very different. A promise would be similar to, I want to learn to play the piano. I begin to meet with an instructor, and the instructor tells me, now, if you practice every day, you will become a good pianist. And that's the context in which a spiritual promise is made. You know, so an opportunity is given, and if the way of life is lived, if I practice the piano, I'm going to become a good pianist. I can't say, I'm going to skip the practice, not do anything, but because I'm, you know, got this piano, I had this instructor, now I'm going to be a good pianist, right? You know, it's like, it's cutting out the substance of the promise. So in a similar way in the spiritual life, yes, these promises in the scapular are real, but the promises are connected with a fanning in the flame of the graces of baptism, a desire to follow the way of the Lord Jesus, to be a faithful disciple, to die to ourselves so we might live for him. And if we cut out all that and say, well, I'm still going to get the promise, then that's not how promises work in the spiritual life. And that's foolishness. We can't engage in sinful activity somehow thinking presumptuously, well, because I wear the scapular, everything's going to be okay. You know, that's using the sacramental against itself. And that's not how spiritual promises work.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Father Jeffrey Kirby about Our Lady of Mount Carmel and the brown scapular. And as we wrap up the interview today, if we were to talk about the meaning of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, what people in their devotion to her and the brown scapular, what are the things that people can take away from this, something that came to us in 1251, St. Simon Stock, so many centuries ago? What can its meaning be for us today in our modern world?
Yes, I think that we live in a secular world that tells us God doesn't exist. There's no right or wrong. Prayer has no power. I think by wearing the brown scapular and trying to dive into the spiritual treasury of the Church, spiritual wisdom of the Church, we can find the needs and the helps that we need in order to continue to live in the knowledge, the sure knowledge, that God does exist, there is right and wrong, and prayer is very powerful. And so the scapular can help us to be a reminder, to help us to hold fast to these truths and to hold on to the way of the Lord Jesus in a world that tells us that, you know, these things aren't worth anything. So I think very much in the secular age, the scapular is needed. It's literally a visible, tangible reminder to us of these spiritual truths. It also is a call to discipleship. Because every day, we are, you know, led to dozens and dozens of different decisions. And just having the scapular upon our bodies is a reminder that we do not live for ourselves, that we are called to die to ourselves that we might live more fully for Jesus Christ. So I think in these ways and many others, the scapular is very much needed today. It can be a great help to baptize Christians in our contemporary world.
Very well put. Well, we've been talking today with Father Jeffrey Kirby about Our Lady of Mount Carmel and his book, Journey to Mount Carmel. And I know you have a website, Father, where you have your books and your podcasts and your other projects you're working on. Tell us where people can go to find out more about you.
Yes. So my website, frkirby.com. Also, I have a daily video devotional that's available at Morning Offering with Father Kirby. So if you just Google Morning Offering with Father Kirby, that pops right up.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Father Jeffrey Kirby, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you, Michael. God bless you.
God bless. That was Father Jeffrey Kirby, author of Journey to Mount Carmel, a 9-day preparation for investiture in the brown scapular of Our Lady. Tomorrow is the feast day of Our Lady of Mount Carmel. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Joyce Driga, talking to us about Augustus Tolton, and Father Jeffrey Kirby, author of Journey to Mount Carmel, a 9-day preparation for investiture in the brown scapular of Our Lady. Check out my EWTN television series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tonight's show is a visit to the Marian Shrine of Guadalupe. I'll be going there to investigate the mysterious image emblazoned on St. Juan Diego's tilma that has inspired millions of believers. And check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from 10 books and available at ewtnrc.com. I'd like to thank you today for joining me on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.